This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
I think we'll always be people who prefer the real thing. And the idea would be to replace as much of that as we can to bring down the emissions associated with traditional agriculture, keeping in mind that not everybody around the world or even the United States is going to want this product, because meat is not just meat. It is a way of life in so many places.
This week on Sea Change Radio, we take a closer look at the alternative meat industry with Matt Simon, a senior writer at Grist. We look back at some of the initial stumbles from companies such as Impossible Foods, what they're doing now to make their products more appealing to consumers, examine the prospects of some of the fresher faces in the business of lab-grown meat, like Mission Barns, and discuss the sustainability benefits of this burgeoning segment of the food industry. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Matt Simon. He's a senior staff writer for Grist. Matt, welcome back to Sea Change Radio.
And thanks for having me again.
You've written a couple pieces for Grist recently, focusing on the alternative meat space. Let's first start with the most recent piece, Why the Future of Meat Production is in Vats, Not Farms. I've been speaking to people in the alternative meat space for over a decade, and it's always very promising, and yet it hasn't really caught on to the level of a lot of the hype covering this. Do you think that maybe we've turned the corner?
Certainly. I think what's really interesting about alternative meats is that, like any technology, as it progresses, it'll get cheaper and better. So traditional meat is a stagnant, not even a technology, but really this whole system that we've built for thousands of years. There's no improving on, a burger, other than if you're cooking it really well, better than others. But these alternative meats are coming out that are getting cheaper. They're getting to be better imitations of traditional meats. So for one of the stories here, I sampled a couple of products, a meatball and salami, from a company called Mission Barns that is cultivating pork fat in vats. So they take a tiny sample of fat from a pig and then cultivate it, grow it indoors, and then mix that with plant-based materials to get this new product that we've never had in human history. And I think that's what's really fascinating about this technology, is that yes, it has been historically expensive, but that will get better over time as the technology progresses.
So Mission Barns isn't really making meat. They're making fat and then adhering it to what kind of plant materials?
So it depends on the product. They're using things like soy or pea proteins, depending on if it's a salami or a meatball. It's another really interesting aspect to this, is that these food scientists can really experiment with lots of different ingredients, lots of different ways of combining this cultivated fat with these plant-based ingredients. And over time, they can iterate, like a company would iterate on a piece of hardware or software. And I don't know if anybody remembers the first iterations of Impossible Burgers or Beyond Burgers weren't as good as they are today, because they improved that over time. And now we have something, at least to my mind, the Impossible Burger is a pretty darn close approximation of the real thing.
I haven't had Impossible Burgers lately, but they've improved the recipe.
I would say so. At least I've noticed, but taste is subjective, right? Maybe not everybody would agree. And it's interesting because it goes beyond the taste. It's the texture. It's the thing known as mouthfeel that these food scientists also have to nail. You run the risk of running into this sort of uncanny valley of meat. So with robots, you see something that's so close to being human, yet isn't it? It freaks out the human mind. That is the risk here with these alternative meat industries, is that if you don't get really close, or basically identical to the real thing, there's a chance that people are turned off by it.
Yes, that's what I was going to ask you about Impossible Burger, Matt, because I remember Burger King was touting its Impossible Whopper, and then I think it promptly left their menu. Was that because of taste or lack of marketing? What do the experts in the industry point to in that? Because that could have been a real watershed moment for mass acceptance of these alternative meats.
I'm not sure what their specific reason was, but there has been this broader shift in the industry. So, Impossible and Beyond started out really hammering home this idea that this is better for the environment. And unfortunately, the fact of the matter is that I don't think the broader American public really cares about that aspect of it. They just want something that tastes good. I of course write for a climate change website, so I am concerned about climate change and the climate impact of the traditional meat industry. But I think there's been this shift recently where because they're getting so close to approximating that realness of the meat, that this is now more, okay, well, this is a better for the planet, to be sure, but also it tastes great. I'm an adult, but I have this weird obsession with the Impossible chicken nuggets. I eat chicken nuggets at home as a 41-year-old, because they, to me, taste exactly like a regular chicken nugget. I will eat those for the rest of my life, no matter how old I get. It's this really interesting technological leap that I think the industry is moving away from, maybe even at some point shaming people for eating meat, into, well, here's an alternative. It's at price parity and it tastes excellent, so why not adopt it?
But isn't one of the reasons it tastes so good is that it's got a lot of processed materials, and we've looked at some of the effects on human health. It's not necessarily this ingredient or that ingredient as much as the processed foods, which really have a deleterious long-term effect on the bodies. So are we eating something healthier when we're eating Impossible Nuggets versus McDonald's Chicken McNuggets?
This is another hurdle for the industry. This sort of backlash that we've had, and specifically in the United States, against processed foods in recent years, which are proven to be bad for human health. When we are considering these alternative meats, they are healthier than the real thing, especially when it comes to like public safety. You know, you're getting these sorts of E. coli outbreaks in traditional meat, but these are not health foods. Just to be very clear that this stuff has fat, it has salt, and it has a lot of processed ingredients. I would argue that it's going to be better for you than the real thing, because these are plant-based, but I would not exclusively eat my chicken nuggets from Impossible, because my body needs other nutrients, and I don't think that would end up well for me. But this is I think, a struggle for the industry still against this processed food backlash in the United States, which is happening for good reason, because these food companies have been poisoning us with things like breakfast cereals for many decades now. We need to eat healthier, but I would argue that doing so involves shifting away from traditional meat as we've known it.
Well, the hardest work that ever I done was plowing a field of rye. The easiest work that ever I done was eating chicken pie. Chicken crow for midnight and a chicken crow for day. Long coming, oh Lord have mercy, stole my chicken away. Crow back chicken and crow for day. Crow back chicken and fly away. Crow back chicken and I like chicken pie.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio, and I'm speaking to Matt Simon. He's a senior staff writer at Grist. So, Matt, you're talking about the ingredients that go into some of these alternative meats. Without sounding like I'm in lockstep with the Secretary of Human Health Services, one issue is protein. Can you give us kind of a snapshot of the comparison in protein content in the alternative meats versus a traditional meat product? Is it comparable?
No, I haven't seen any direct comparisons. It's an interesting question. It is protein all the same. It's just protein derived from plants, which I think is the technological marvel here. Like, this is soy protein, pea protein. These are similar structures to what we find in meat, which is how they've been able to nail something like the Impossible Burger's sort of chewiness. Again, this mouthfeel that is so important to get people to switch these alternative meats. That's a great question. I'm not sure about the direct amount of protein comparison. I've been hearing that maybe in America we are obsessing a little bit too much about protein. Like, you probably don't need the amount that a lot of these influencers are telling you you need. It's also just, you know, if we're talking about traditional meat, it's just a tremendous burden on the environment if we're increasing our meat consumption. And of course, that comes with human health implications as well.
Just doing a quick Google search while you were talking, though, it says it's equivalent. The Impossible Burger patty contains 19 grams of protein for a 4-ounce serving, which is about the same as 80-20 ground beef. So we're here in the Bay Area, and that's kind of the ground zero for a lot of venture capital and investments. How are the finances evolving in this space? For example, how is Mission Barns doing, and are they getting outside investment, or are they already profitable?
There's still interest in funding these sorts of technologies. Mission Barns is in its very, very early stages. I was actually one of the first people to try it out in the wild at a restaurant actually not far from here in the Inner Sunset District of San Francisco. That was not very long served to the general public. They did a brief sale in Berkeley at a grocery store of some of their products. But at this point, they're trying to scale up to be able to sell more places. There has also been a broader pullback in things like Beyond Burger and Impossible sales, again, because of this backlash, I think, against processed foods. So that'll be interesting to see in the years going forward how much of the market share is going to be eaten up, no pun intended, by the cultivated things like what Mission Barns is doing, because it is such a really remarkable approximation of real pork. It tastes pretty darn near the real thing. Is that going to become more popular than the purely plant-based things that Impossible and Beyond are doing? TBD. These products are getting cheaper, but they're not always as cheap as the real thing.
Speaking of the real thing, one of the challenges that the alternative meats industry faces is trying to replicate the many different ways that we eat meats. So you mentioned Mission Barns has this meatball and a salami, but there's 10 other different ways that I could think of off the top of my head of ways to eat pork alone. What are some of the holy grails that these alternative meat producers are trying to formulate? Can Mission Barns come up with a ham and a bacon sometime soon?
They do, in fact, have a bacon. I was able to try that. That was one of the dishes at the restaurant, was a little piece of bacon on top of a potato. It was quite good. This is where it gets even more interesting, is this idea of structured and unstructured meat, which doesn't sound particularly appetizing. But the idea with unstructured meat, what Mission Barns is doing, is that you have goop is not the right word. That's not appetizing either. But it's a meatball is this sort of mushy meat that you can add a bunch of ingredients to, form it into a ball, and that, because it has that pork fat that's been cultivated in a bioreactor, it tastes really close. A pork loin is an entirely different beast. This is a structured meat, and this is going to require a whole lot more effort to nail down. Think of everything that's in a pork loin, the fat, the protein, the mouthfeel. It's a completely different animal. Like, sorry, again, no pun intended. That these engineers are going to have to create. There's already early advances in this sort of thing. Like, you can imagine a food-based 3D printer churning out these sorts of things. But then we're going to come back to this uncanny valley effect. Do we run the risk of people not wanting to eat these things if they're not exactly like what's coming from a natural animal?
The lab itself, how scalable is that? Are we talking about just the genesis of these products and then eventually they can be replicated in mass without these bioreactors? Or is this, are these products that are going to have to be where big pharma meets big ag?
I think what's interesting here is that the scalability challenge of, making this cheap enough to do at a large scale, but also the benefit, if you are growing these things in bioreactors, you can site these factories closer to human population. Like, think about a pig or a cow farm out in a rural area. They have to be shipped to a meat processing plant that then has to be shipped into cities. The idea here is that you can just take one of these factories, site it where there's a dense human population, and then you cut down on both the costs and the carbon emissions associated with shipping these products around. I think that's the real promise here, is that, again, traditional agriculture is a stagnant technology. There's, I mean, all the improvements that have happened over the past couple of thousand years are what we get. The promise of alternative meats is that you can not only keep iterating on the technology and on your food, but to more effectively site these production facilities to cut down on emissions.
And we haven't really dipped our toe into the seafood water, another pun there. How does the industry differentiate pig products, chicken products, replicating those types of meat versus seafood meats? Are they one and the same, or are all these different ventures kind of going off on their own little meat tangents?
Yeah, they're focusing on usually one product, but this technology is actually sort of universal for meat. So all you're doing, whether it's a fish cell or a pig cell, is you're just adding certain ingredients to encourage its growth. You're replicating the conditions in the body of that animal. So you can imagine any meat that we're eating can be grown in these sorts of bioreactors. And then think about different sorts of formulations. Like, would you want to grow both pig fat and beef fat, mix them together, and then add it to a meatball? Or would that be gross? I don't know. So there's this sort of experimentation that comes as the technology progresses. But yeah, it's the technology is sort of agnostic as to what animal you're growing.
So is aquaculture not part of this equation, or is it?
No, I mean, ideally you move away from that. It's an environmentally destructive industry, and it is probably not great for animal welfare either, which is a whole other thing we haven't really touched on yet either. The benefits of alternative meats. You like with the pig that whose fat was cultured, it was a little tiny sample, and they're able to take that and create masses of this fat because they're feeding it the right ingredients to replicate the conditions in that pig's body. Her name is Dawn, by the way. She lives on a sanctuary in upstate New York. And the idea here is that we avoid growing as many animals as we possibly can, because there's an inherent waste in that. Like, you should think about the water and food, energy and effort that goes into producing a pig, not all of which we're consuming. We just want the meat. We don't really want the bones or internal organs or eyeballs or things like that. This alternative meat industry is simplifying. We're just growing the meat that we're consuming, and it is inherently more efficient in that way.
Thank you.
got a big home in the pen. Corn to feed him on. All I need, pretty little girl, feed him when I'm gone. Going on a mountain so little Cain raise a battle stock from the sweet Eliza Jane.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio, and I'm speaking to Matt Simon. He's a senior staff writer at Grist. So, Matt, in your opinion, do you think that these alternative meats will eventually have a spot at the table at some of these higher-end cuisines? You were talking about trying to replicate the pork loin. If that happens, then will people accept it, and will it be served at fancy restaurants? And also, seafood is such a specialized industry, thinking of like Korea and Japan, countries that really have a deep seafood culture. Is there potential there, or is this going to be something that's going to be just McNuggets and salami and Impossible Whoppers?
I think it's really important to keep in mind here that meat is, for a lot of people around the world, more than just meat, right? It's fishermen who are making a living on this, and you know, pastoralist cultures that livestock is not just meat. It's currency. It's these sorts of things.
It's culture.
Yeah, right. I mean, it's inherent to all human civilization, right? We're just, with these new industries, these technologies, finding ways to replace some of that in certain contexts. I would be very surprised if in the near future these alternative meats took over entirely, like replaced all the traditional agriculture that we have in the United States. I think will always be people who prefer the real thing. And the idea would be to replace as much of that as we can to bring down the emissions associated with traditional agriculture, keeping in mind that not everybody around the world, or even the United States, is going to want this product, because meat is not just meat. It is a way of life in so many places.
Speaking of Japan and Korea, while they may have a very specialized seafood industry or meat industry and take their meat and seafood eating very seriously, these traditional meats are very resource intensive and not good for the environment, and they have limited land, very limited compared to the US. So it seems like those countries would be well suited for it on the surface, but then we have this ethno-cultural barrier to overcome, or the industry has that ethno-cultural barrier to overcome.
I think the land bit is interesting. I'm glad you brought that up, because so much of the land around the world is dedicated not just to housing livestock, but growing the feed that is arguably inefficiently fed to them to grow the meat that then we consume. The idea with these alternative meats is that you grow the plants directly, you turn them into protein, and you turn them into these products. Ideally, that uses a lot less land than traditional agriculture, which is responsible for things like deforestation and corrupting water supplies with toxicants, things like that. So I think, yeah, in land constrained places, I would assume this could be quite powerful. But elsewhere, we just need to dedicate less land to indirectly feeding us with crops that go to animals that then is turned into meat.
So Impossible Foods and Beyond Meat, are they the industry leaders in the U.S.? And you said that they're not actually expanding as much as they had originally hoped. But give us an idea of the size of these companies and where they need to get to scale and then start seeing the prices become much more competitive. And in the same breath, we are seeing, you know, rising meat prices as well.
Yeah, I think sales remain strong. There's not, you know, growing like they used to. I don't have the numbers of their market share in front of me. But I'm assuming that as these technologies improve, that they're going to increase adoption. They're also moving away from a lot of times this almost shaming of people for eating regular meat and more toward this stuff tastes good. It's really close to the real thing. As the price comes down, does that improve the economics for the average American? Butting up again against this increasing hostility toward processed foods, even though regular meat is not healthy for you at all. Yet we still do it because we have this this culture of meat, and you can't tell people to stop eating that. You just have to make it more and more literally appetizing to them to make the switch.
I had a question about that projection that you quoted in your piece, Why the Future of Meat Production is in Vats, Not Farms. You write that in the last 25 years, meat production is up about 65%, and it'll probably be up something like 65% again in the next 25 years. Now, are those projections incorporating alternative meats or not?
I do not think so. I would assume those are looking more at both population growth as well as economies develop, people come up into the middle class, they're able to afford more meat, and you have increased consumption that way. The alternative meats industry is so small, and it's hard to really tell, like, to project forward what the growth is going to be like. It's a population growth thing and an increased wealth thing as well. As a closing thought, I would encourage people, if you ever come across these cultivated meats in particular from Mission Barns or otherwise, to give it a shot. It's a, like, at the very least, it is a fundamentally strange thing. You realize that the thing is not real, like, it's not an actual pork meatball, but it's so close that your brain gets a little confused. And if given the option, I would replace pork consumption with these meatballs and salami. I think they're that good. And from here, they're only going to get better. And especially as more of these companies come up and they're doing chicken and beef and fish as well, just keep an eye out for these things. You don't have to, I'm not telling you to switch your entire diet over to these alternatives, but just from the fascinating aspects of what it's doing to your brain, I actually quite encourage it.
Well, I'll let you get back to your fake chicken McNuggets. It sounds like you should be on their short list for endorsements. He's a senior staff writer at Grist, Matt Simon. Matt, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Certainly, and thank you.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise.
Additional music by Little Sonny, Rye Cooter, and Ralph Stanley.
Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.